Okay, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the conclusion of our series on the women of the S&P Sephardi community. This is the sixth and final lecture within the numbers. Hi, good evening. What I hope tonight we'll do, I mean, we've been studying this subject for 6 months. We've learned about some remarkable individuals, you know, the important work that they did, understood, you know, what was occurring in, you know, in the 19th century that we said really was this incredible moment of change that's taking place within the Western Jewish world, right, within the English-speaking world. And we spoke about all the kind of changes and challenges that were taking place. Let me just kind of quickly review them, just make sure we're kind of all on the same page over here. What was unique about that moment, you know, the 1820s forward?
Local Jews.
Sorry?
Jews born.
Right. The majority of the population at that point would have been native born, right? The first time that would have happened, and the last time until you get to, our time, right? So you're going to have a native population, okay? Right? That would be changing.
Is that global?
No, within the English-speaking world, right? So within England, within America, right? The 1820s, most of the Jews that are there have been born there, okay? Now, coupled with that is, let's talk about change that's happening, right? One major change is mass migration, right? So there's going to be all of this immigration, right? At this point, we're talking about typically German or what we call, might call Central European Jewish immigration, right? The numbers will dwarf the original numbers that are there. Like there'll be a large change as a result. That certainly in America will really change the landscape. Okay, so immigration will take place. What else? What other changes?
There was some proselytizing.
Yeah, right, yeah. So there's conversion, right, that's taking place, right? Conversionists. Okay, that's a challenge or change, yeah. What else?
The rise of reform.
Right, reform will happen.
Also, the beginning of emancipation.
Yeah, emancipation will, right, this will be the big fight for emancipation. It'll be not as much an issue in America because essentially Jews will be mostly emancipated at the time of the American Revolution, right, but in England it won't really happen until the 1850s, right, so they'll be fighting for that during this time. Excellent. And one other issue that's happening, right, that perhaps relates to this, right, is going to be general assimilation. Okay, great. So these are a lot of things that really, I would say, define, right, this time period, right? We talk about the 1820s, right, on, okay? That's going to be defining characteristics in this, right? And what's going to happen is it's going to be necessary for, shall we say, the Jewish community or for Jews to respond to these challenges or to tackle these challenges to, kind of think about how they're going to react to them. What we found is that, well, not entirely, but that a large portion of those responses are being driven by women, right? The women are taking the lead in a lot of these reactions, or at least in some of them, right? And that there's not as much what you would expect kind of intellectual responses to these challenges coming from men. You will find a bit from some of the ministers, right? But in terms of men in general, they're not the ones producing kind of the reactions to these issues. It's women that are really kind of taking the lead in how to deal with these different challenges, right? And so we've looked over the past months at a number of different women that played a really important role within this. So let's just kind of review for ourselves, right? Who are the people that we've spoken about?
Montefiore.
Yeah, so yeah, Lady Judith Montefiore, right? So Judith. And what is her role? What does she do? I mean, she's a famous person, but what is she doing? Okay. But she's the most famous person you think of, right? You think of a woman in the 19th century, you think of Judith Montefiore. So what is she doing?
It's the what I can think of at the moment is the, it's not exactly the cookbook, but then I was keeping up.
Yes, right. So she has this cookbook, yeah. But broadly speaking, she's involved in a lot of kind of communal activity,
right? So she's kind of involved in these different roles. She's a wealthy woman. She's involved in different boards and different institutions, right? So she's playing, I would say, a role in kind of leadership, right? And her cookbook kind of comes out of that, right? That attempt to help people kind of integrate and to move from lower class to middle class, right? She's trying to help these immigrants to perhaps become British, right? She's trying to help support people that are kind of dealing with the challenges of that time. Good, okay, so that's one. Who else do we have?
Grace Atwood.
Grace Atwood, yeah. Okay, now what is she doing?
Well, she wrote, not specifically for the Jewish readership, but was accepted outside.
Right, so she's writing literature. She's writing literature for the general public on Jewish themes, or, you know, with Jewish individuals, right, in them. And then she's also writing stories for the Jewish community as well, right? She's writing novels, she's writing poetry, that type of writing. Excellent. Okay. Who else?
Miriam Mendes-Bedesan.
Yeah, okay. Miriam Mendes Elisario. And what's her contribution?
She has, education. And it's sort of a, broadly speaking, educational literature.
Right, so education. Right, so she's writing educational literature.
Excellent.
Particularly a certain kind of, yeah, she's running a school, that's good. But particularly, right, she's writing polemic.
Yeah. Polemic, yeah.
Right, if we could look at it that way. Good. Excellent. Who else?
Abigail Lindo.
Yeah, Abigail Lindo. Yeah, and what is she doing?
She's outside education, no?
She writes a book on vocab. Right, about Hebrew vocab, and she's also an educator. She's running a school, right? So she's running a school too, right? We mentioned at that time there would have perhaps been the synagogue schools, but there also were all these private schools as well that, right, kind of people would have been maybe smaller groups of tutors, right? That people would have had, perhaps people that were a little bit wealthier, right? People would have gone to the synagogue school that would have maybe been known as the poor school, right? Excellent. Abigail Lindo, and one other person, also Montefiore.
Charlotte.
Yeah, excellent. Charlotte Montefiore. Right, and what does she do?
The Chief Jewish Library.
Yeah, so she's involved with Chief Jewish Library, right? Excellent. Yeah, so she writes that. She puts together this compilation of books that Jews can read on Jewish themes, right? And she also writes a really important work of polemic as well, right? She says, something, it's like the title, I forget the exact title, something like, you know, to the Jews from one of their own, right? She's like, write to the Jewish community about things that she thinks they need to hear, okay? Right, so I would say she's really doing polemic. She's definitely doing, I would say, focus more, she's doing educational literature, right? Excellent, good. So those are the figures, right, that we've been looking at, right, and seeing, right, this work that they are doing, right? And they're all trying to respond in different ways. Some of them are directing their efforts at children. Some of them are directing their efforts to adults, right? It's the different groups within the community, right? But essentially what they're trying to do is to help Jews fend off conversionist tactics by talking about issues of conversion, right? Right, so we'll kind of address those types of issues. They'll be trying to help immigrants to become part of the Anglo-Jewish community. They'll be responding to questions of reform. They'll be, broadly speaking, dealing with assimilation and so on. Emancipation, that's gonna be left a little bit more to the men, right? The men are gonna deal with that issue, right? But essentially they are, broadly speaking, providing this whole group of literature to that, yes.
But to put it in context, wasn't the general population getting more educated? There were similar things going on in the community.
And
this just reflected what was going on.
In what community?
Yeah.
In what community are people getting more educated?
In the middle class.
Perhaps. But what's interesting is that it's women leading the way with that. And that's not entirely different than what you might be finding in the societies. Are all the famous female writers, right, from the 19th century as well. We also have plenty of examples of male writers as well. And you don't really have that within the Jewish community.
There isn't a Jewish Dickens.
Correct.
There is, I mean, one could argue that.
Certainly not in terms of addressing Jewish issues.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there may be men doing really important work, maybe starting to become scientists or whatever, but in terms of writing things that are essentially
for the Jewish community, you know, right? Torah literature, we could even call it that, you know, religious literature, right? It's women that are doing that. Now, we mentioned that there was somebody common denominator between these women.
Remember what those were?
Sorry, Dave.
Sorry?
Well, besides family being sort of interrelated.
Some of them had some relation. Yeah, some had some relation.
But also, they were all coming here.
So yeah, so one point is that obviously, right, is that they are Sephardic, right? Or at least in the Sephardic community, right? Lady Judith, her family's Ashkenaz, but she's in the Sephardic community. She goes to the Bemismarks, right? Her husband is Sir Moses. And there was something else about them as well. Perhaps she's the one exception.
Oh, they aren't married.
They're not married, right? They're single, right? Or at least they're at least doing their productivity whilst they're single. Some of them will eventually get married and then they basically stop, right? They're writing while they're single, right? And so those are things that you'll find about them as well, though they definitely, a lot of them are writing about themes of motherhood, which was really interesting, about saying the importance of mothers in educating their children. We're seeing the important role, essentially, that women play in the education of the next generation. Seemingly what they're saying is either through your biological children or through the children of the community, right? Through the people of the community and that perhaps single women see as their children as well, okay? And so that's all happening, right? And this is all, right, happening in London, right? So this is happening in London, okay? So we got to see kind of through all these people, they're all, in a sense, doing these things, you know, nearly individually, but the combination of all of them feels like a little bit like a movement, right? That there's kind of this energy, this kind of understanding that this is something that women in the community do, right? And that's remarkable because you don't think of Jewish women doing this kind of work until maybe more recent times, right? And see that already, you know, nearly, you know, two centuries ago within the Sephardic community, that was, I guess, women were doing, you know, work that was important. Maybe not the kinds of scholarship that are, you know, meant that they were Talmudists in that way, right? And so they talk about that they would like more education, right? But they are producing material, right, that can be used for educational purposes, and that's really significant, okay? What we're going to be doing tonight as the final lecture is saying that this theme is not localized to London, right? That it's actually happening, say this term, throughout the Spanish and Portuguese, English-speaking world, right? That it's also happening on the other side of the Atlantic as well. And we're going to look at a number of individuals who this we find similar things happening with them too. That we're going to try to do them all in one lecture, right? So we're not going to kind of go in as in depth into them as we had done with the other people on the board, but we will have a chance to kind of look through them and understand them a bit more. The community that we're going to be primarily looking at is going to be Philadelphia. Now, Philadelphia is really, I think, kind of interesting because it has its moment. Okay, it's going to have its moment in time where it is essentially going to be the capital of Jewish America. Okay, after the American Revolution, those early years, the place that's going to have the greatest growth and maybe even wealth is going to be Charleston, South Carolina. Okay, that's going to be a place that's going to very well with trade, right? They have the cotton and indigo, right? They do trade perhaps back with England. They're going to do very well. There's going to be a change in the tax system and tariffs that the north, that the states are going to impose on the southern states. That's going to cause mean that the southern states have to trade their goods first to the northern states. They're going to manufacture them into finished goods. They will then sell them over to England, right? So the South is not going to have the same financial benefit from the production of cotton that they used to have. It will decline economically. It will ultimately lead to war, right, within the states. But it's still before New York will become this great city. By the 1820s, all of America has 2,000 Jews. There's not a lot of Jews living there. A few hundred here, a few hundred there, a few hundred there, you know, within the few communities that are there, right? These different Spanish Portuguese communities that were founded during British colonial times. People primarily coming over from London, right, and settling in British colonies. the latter part of the 19th century, certainly followed 1880 with the mass migration of Eastern European Jews, will flood New York City with Jewish Eastern European immigrants, 1.5 million of them, right? And so New York will obviously become the, you know, capital of Jewish America, and as it still is until this day. But during those middle years of the 19th century, it's actually Philadelphia that has kind of the greatest, even if not in numbers, even the numbers of German Jews moving into America is already starting to grow the New York population. There seems to be this thing happening in Philadelphia of great kind of energy and vigor and intellectual vigor and developing of communal institutions. And a lot of kind of the institutions will become kind of part of the American Jewish kind of scene will have been founded in Philadelphia in the middle of the 19th century. So it's a really important place for American Jewry during that time. And we're going to see a lot of activity that we're looking at is going to be taking place in Philadelphia. Okay, so let's just take a look. I'm just going to do a couple comparisons just to give people a sense of the ways in which these places are similar. So first of all, when we think of London, we think of David Aaron DeSola, right, whose picture we have over here. In Philadelphia, we have a different minister. His name is Isaac Leeser, who will be there in the 19th century. He's interesting. His family, he's actually Ashkenaz. He grows up in Central Europe, but he moves to America when he's about 19. He has an uncle living in Richmond, Virginia, which at that point had a small Spanish-Portuguese community. Whilst there, he gets trained in the Spanish-Portuguese tradition, and then will eventually be hired in Philadelphia to be the rabbi of Mikveh Israel because of some of his early polemic writings against reform that will be starting to develop in Charleston. So he kind of gets a bit of a reputation for himself. He gets hired in Philadelphia, and he produces the first English translation of the Bible. He writes books for the school, and one of the things that he does that's the most important is he launches a newspaper, the first newspaper called The Occident, and it will be there for about 30 years, right? So he'll be involved in The Occident. David Aaron, he'll be involved, not as the one leading it, but in contributing and being an editor to the first Jewish newspaper in London, which is called The Voice of Jacob, right? That'll be around for about 10 years, and then we'll merge into the Jewish Chronicle, right, which is founded around the same time, okay? So each of them are kind of there in their community. They're both producing more kind of rabbinic or scholarly type works or translations, and they're both involved in the first Jewish papers in those places, right? And so they're both doing it, and those are really the preeminent figures in each of those, right, in America and in England at that time. Okay. Now, in addition, obviously you have here in London, you have Bevis Marks, right? Shar HaShemaim, and you also have Duke's Place Synagogue, right? The big Ashkenazi community as well. Typically in America, you would have had perhaps one synagogue, but Philadelphia is different. Philadelphia actually has two synagogues. They have an Ashkenazi synagogue that's been founded in the early 1800s called Rodef Shalom, which will, you know, still in existence today. Now it's a Reform congregation, but at that point it was an Ashkenazi Orthodox, right? That's all that was. I don't know if we could even call it Orthodox at that time. That's just what there was, right? So there was an Orthodox Ashkenazi synagogue and the colonial era Spanish-Portuguese synagogue known as Mikveh Israel, right? And this is what their building looked like after 1850. I believe it was the fourth building in the history of that community. And so that was in Philadelphia. You can see really a impressive, beautiful building. It gives you a sense, right, of the kind of the significance of that community at the time, that they could build such a grand and impressive synagogue building. Okay, so that's a bit about kind of the similarities. There's more similarities. The big philanthropist in England is obviously Moses Montefiore. The big philanthropist developing in America is going to be Judah Turo, who will actually join efforts a bit with Sir Moses with some of his buildings in the land of Israel. Right, so a lot of ways there's this, a parallel between the communities. Turo doesn't live in Philadelphia, but he does develop a relationship with Leeser, and Leeser helps bring him along to become a person that supports Jewish causes. And so that's something that I wanted to just kind of see how, in a lot of ways, there's a similarity. Obviously, the community in London is much larger. It's a much larger Jewish community, but there are these interesting parallels that are happening. But if you kind of take the entire American population and compare it to the London Sephardic population, then you're actually getting a little bit more similar, right? So if you take all these colonial Irish, Spanish, Portuguese communities and put them together and compare that to London, that's about equal, nearly equal in size, right? So you kind of have to look at the America as one collective. But as I said, at the time we're looking at, the heart of it is going to be in the city of Philadelphia, which of course had been the seat of the American Revolution, right? So it's an important city in America. Okay, but what I want to look at are the important figures in the community. Now, we mentioned the leading lady of Anglo-Jewry is going to be Lady Judith Montefiore, right? Involved in important institution building, different organizations, caring for the poor and so on. The figure in Philadelphia that she'll become kind of incredibly famous is this lady over here, Rebecca Gratz. Rebecca Gratz is kind of the woman of 19th century America. She's said to have been this beautiful woman who never married. She was part of the elite. She kind of was very involved with mingling with Jews and non-Jewish circles. Apparently had several opportunities to marry, turned down those oftentimes even from non-Jewish suitors. Some say that she became the model for the character Rebecca in Ivanhoe, right? This Jewish woman that kind of has this relationship with this non-Jewish man, but turns it down in order to retain her faith. And so some people say from Walter Scott that perhaps his inspiration was Rebecca Gratz. Perhaps they had some people in common. That's debatable whether that's the case, or maybe even not debatable, I'm not sure. But that's at least kind of a rumor that people said. So it gives you a sense at least about kind of the character of who she was. And she went on to found a number of institutions. Probably one of the most significant one is she's the person who founds the Sunday school movement. Beforehand, the synagogue would have run its own school that would have essentially been a Jewish day school. But in the 1830s, 1840s, there'll be the kind of the development of the public school system. And the public school system will mean that the government will no longer give funds to private schools, right, to religious schools, in which case it starts making it difficult for synagogue schools to stay in business. And instead, there will be this growing sense of either you have no choice, or it's actually a good thing to send your kids to a public school. That way they can, meet other children of different religions. But of course, when it comes to religious study, you learn that within your own people, right? And that was kind of the development of the Sunday school movement that she launches in Philadelphia. And that will become kind of the standard in America for a very long time. It won't be without debate. Historians refer to that as the Protestant model, right? We're Protestants in America, right? It's predominantly a Protestant country. We'll send their kids to public schools and they have Sunday school for learning about Christianity, as opposed to what becomes known as the Catholic model by historians, which essentially says that the Catholics look at public schools in America and they say they're not schools free of religion, they're Protestant schools. And therefore, Catholics say that the only way to ensure that Catholicism is ingrained within their children is they need to actually set up, full-day schools, Catholic schools for their children. So Catholics won't send their kids to public school. They will create private schools for Catholic children. And there will obviously be Jews that will say that we need to do the same thing as well, and we'll set up full-day schools for Jewish children, right? And that will be a debate that will happen, though for a long time, it's the Sunday school movement that really wins out in America, as it was in this country. And then we see kind of a re-emergence of the Jewish day school movement as well, starting to happen, kind of following more that Catholic model. But she's a really important figure, and she's involved in these institutions. I mean, I don't have it here, there's a picture of her as an old lady. I mean, she is going strong for a very, very long time. Born in like 1780, dies in the 1860s. She lives a long life, and is a really important leader. She is in a sense, the first lady of American Jewry in the 19th century. And so she's an important figure. But there's a number of women that do really important writing as well. And I want to just take a look at some of the things that they write. The first one we're going to look at is actually really interesting. Her name was Rebecca Heinemann. Rebecca Heinemann was born to a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother. She then marries a Jewish man, has a child, is expecting with her second child, and her husband goes out west to sell jewels and never comes returns. Rumored that he was killed, that he was murdered. She then gives birth to a second child, and then at that point approaches the synagogue, Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia, to undergo conversion. And we actually have the document stating kind of the, her going before the Bet Din in Philadelphia in the 1845. I'm just going to read to you a little bit what they say over here. And they write the following. It says, Mrs. Heinemann, having been requested to attend the committee and being asked what motive induced her to make the above application, she stated that it was always that it has always been her desire to become a member of the Congregation of Israel, and that no interested motive prompts her to take this step, and that she had always been instructed in the Jewish religion by her father, Abraham Gumpertz. She was admonished that at present she was not bound by the precepts of the law, and that the moment she embraced the religion, she was bound to conform strictly to all the duties and ceremonies of the Jewish religion. To this she replied that it always had been her sincere wish to have the privilege of being a member of the Congregation of Israel, and that as far as is in her power, she would educate and bring up her children in the Jewish faith. And as it goes on, she's accepted and becomes undergoes the conversion and becomes a member of Mikveh Israel with her children. She goes on to write poetry and publish her poetry in Jewish and in non-Jewish circles. And will eventually publish her work in a collection that is titled "The Leper and Other Poems." The Leper is one of the poems that she writes. But one of the poems that I want to read to you, I found interesting because it is a poem that she writes about Grace Aguilar, right? And what I like about this is it shows how that these communities are not entirely independent. They're aware of each other. In fact, we know that there is correspondence often between these people that we've spoken about in London and these ladies in Philadelphia. It's not this kind of completely separate world. They see themselves on some level as part of the same world. In fact, some of the educational material that will be produced, they'll send it overseas and it will be used overseas as well, right? This community in certain regards is still operating as one larger community. And so I'm just going to read to you a poem that she writes upon the unfortunate young death of Grace Aguilar. And you can see what this meant to her, perhaps seeing that in a lot of ways she was following Grace's lead and her also being this, you know, poet and who's publishing in, you know, non-Jewish circles and so on. And so she writes the following. She says, and she writes, a tribute, that's the title, to the memory of the lamented Grace Aguilar. When the sad moaning wind of midnight sighing falls on the ear with a low wailing tone and finds an echo in the heart replying to its wild music's melancholy moan, then will we think of thee. When the pale leaves of autumn's woods are falling, telling that such is man's frail brief career, our hearts will fancy thy sweet voice is calling from those sad relics of the dying year, and tears will fall for thee. And when the first faint blossoms of the spring shall rouse our spirits in their beauteous bloom, each little leaflet's secret whispering will bear a message from the solemn tomb, bidding us to think of thee. Thy spirit loved to hold communion sweet with buds and falling leaf and midnight wind. And each henceforth our chastened hearts shall greet as a loved token of thy gifted mind. Thus will we think of thee. Broken forever is the golden bowl from which thy spirit drank its draught of life. The silver cord is loosened from thy soul, and thou art free from earthly care and strife, from sin and misery. We cannot mourn for thee as one whose lost was but to bloom for a brief hour below, then sink into the grave and be forgot. The cold, unthinking world can never know how much we grieve for thee. Thou wert a stranger unto us. Thy name alone was wafted over the Atlantic wave, But true hearts mourned thy loss when tidings came that thou were in the cold and silent grave. Aye, true hearts mourned for thee. Rest, gentle minstrel, other hands may wreathe a fair garland on some future day, but true and fervent are the thoughts that breathe within our hearts and prompt the simple lay that tells our grief for thee. And it's beautiful. I mean, you can see just how heartfelt it is. They never met. She just read, you know, what she had written and was so moved that she wrote this poem about her. I know, kind of struck me on multiple levels how significant that poem is, doing similar types of writing, being inspired by her, and truly missing Grace after her passing. And so we find that kind of similarity taking place within the community, right? So if we just kind of have our chart over here, right, to think of Lady Judith, right, and over here you have, Rebecca Gratz, right, and here you have Grace Aguilar, and over here you have Heinemann. Okay, so we're seeing that there's other people that also seem to fall into these similar types of categories. The next group that I want to look at are actually two sisters, Simcha and Rachel Peixoto, P-E-I-X-O-T-T-O, Peixoto, right, good Portuguese name. And they write two books for children, for school children. Now, one of the things that's interesting, Rebecca Gratz founds this school, and many of the ladies we're going to look at, these two sisters and then the others, Rebecca Heinemann wasn't involved with it, will all be teachers in the school. And what you'll actually do, this is the founding class. In the future, you will only be able to be hired as a teacher in the school if you had been a student in the school. And so they will end up producing their own teachers. It will only be women who are allowed to be the teachers, though of course they're teaching both boys and girls. But it'll be interesting that it will actually produce their own replacements within the school. So two of the other founders are Simcha and Rachel Peixoto, and they write two books. One, Rachel Peixoto Pike, she writes a book called Scriptural Questions for the Use of Sunday School for the Instruction of Israelites. And her sister Simcha will write a book, Elementary Introduction to the Scriptures for the Use of Hebrew Children. And essentially, these are catechisms. These are a series of questions and answers, often in rhyme, that the children are meant to memorize, right, in order to learn about Jewish belief and to learn about the Bible, okay? And what's interesting about this, and there's an article that I came across from Professor Jonathan Sarna in Brandeis, who's kind of like the preeminent historian on American Jewry, where he looks at these catechisms and actually identifies that these are essentially modeled after Protestant catechisms. That if you look at the catechisms the Protestants have written at that time, they've essentially taken oftentimes the exact lines from the Protestants and reproduced them in the Jewish book, but have simply removed certain ones or edited some of them or added things in when there were questionable theological parts, or if they wanted to add in elements that had to do with the idea of mitzvot and obligation, right, that wouldn't have been in a Christian version of studying the Bible, they'll add those things in. So they're essentially using the Christian one as the model, but then adjusting it. In fact, before they printed these books, they actually used the Protestant catechisms in the school, and they just covered over certain lines, right? That was the original one. They just kind of taped over certain lines so that the children shouldn't be learning those parts. But here they actually went and they kind of wrote their own version, adding things in as well. So I'll read to you a bit from the catechism that was written. And again, it's questions and answers that you had to memorize. Different style than we do today. Who formed you, child, and made you live? God did my life and spirit give. Who kept you safely, can you tell? God keeps me safe and makes me well. Has God made known the way of truth? The Bible is the guide of youth. What should you feel towards God above? Honor and fear and grateful love. Does God know all you do and say? Yes, and my thoughts too, night and day. Have you evil thoughts within? Yes, or I should not often sin. How do your thoughts their evil show? By sinful words and actions too. And does not sin God's anger move? Yes, for I sin against his love. Must you repent with humble heart? Yes, and from every sin depart. And so just kind of a little bit, right, about Jewish beliefs that they've turned into these kind of little these little questions and answers, right? And so that was kind of a popular way of teaching at that time. And again, what was interesting is the way that they kind of borrow, but then adjust to make it work for a Jewish setting. And so again, but you can see this kind of important work. You know, again, all the ladies we're talking about, they're all single. You know, this is what they've devoted their life to. This is actually interesting. Isaac Leeser was also never married as well. And there's kind of like these, I don't know, the different things I've looked at kind of don't know exactly how to address it. It seems that some of them are at least indicating, right, questions about, well, maybe, you know, we're talking about LGBTQ, right, essentially, but at that time that wasn't okay, and so people just remained unmarried, you know. So is that the case for each of them? Some of them, you know, we don't really know. I get the sense there's more that some of these articles are not including, that if you go back to the primary sources, that, you know, maybe rumors from their actual time that have maybe been documented, that because the rumors, they didn't put them into articles, but that there are, you know, that there were kind of questions, you know, at that time about some of those questions. So, you know, the issues of gender are really important within this, and we're going to return to gender in a little bit when we look at one of the other writers, because one of them is actually going to really address the issue of gender within her writings. But it is interesting, you know, some historians look at this and they say, actually, there's a long tradition of women being educators, particularly within the Sephardic community, particularly within the Spanish and Portuguese community, because during their days when they were conversos, when they were hidden Jews in Portugal, right? So who was educating their kids? There were no Jewish schools. The men were out as merchants. It was the role of the mothers to educate their children, and that perhaps it really became this Sephardic, you know, notion of the role that women play in providing education. And the men, they were the merchants, right? But the women are the educators, right? So different than we think of kind of within maybe the Ashkenazi world, where you kind of, you know, it's the rabbis that are the educators, right? Then no, it's actually the women that are meant to be involved in education, to the extent that they want to, you know, they're in their classroom with the children and they feel at a loss that there isn't sufficient, you know, textbooks or materials for them to use. And they will, you know, there will be people, Isaac Leeser will write some things, but that they feel they need to write their own things, right, in order to make sure that the children are sufficiently educated. So those are two important ways, right? And so there, I think, in a lot of ways, doing similar to Mary Mendes Belisario in providing educational material for the children. Okay. Let's go on. Let's talk about some other important figures. Okay. One other person that does some important work, and here I'm not going to really go into her so much, but she's important in that she also becomes the head of the school. Her name is Helen Phillips. Helen Phillips. She's from a really important family, the Phillips family. Her grandfather, Jonas Phillips, actually goes to the Constitutional Convention to try and lobby for equal rights for Jews after the Revolution. Her grandma has something like 21 children. One woman. I mean, they're an important family. She's a cousin. Exactly. Yeah, he has a cousin, Uriah Phillips Levy, who will become the first Jewish commodore in the U.S. Navy. He's the one who is responsible for banning flogging in the Navy as a punishment. So it's important. It's an important family. And again, many of these women, that's some of the similarities between them, is that some of them are really coming from the upper class. I mean, that's another kind of similarity that we might find with some of these women, is that this is like, you know, as an upper class woman, you have extra funds. Some of them give huge amounts in donations upon their death and their wills, right? So these women are really not just kind of working, they're actually supporting many of these institutions as well. And so she had run a school as well, and then what will happen is Gretz will be kind of the first one to run the school, and then kind of when she passes, it'll kind of keep being handed down to generation after generation, or, you know, the surviving ones to take over the lead of the school until they all pass, then it will go to,
you know, a later generation to take over. But a lot of these women will kind of be involved in leading the school as well, right? So in that way, I kind of saw similarity between her and Abigail Lindo. And one other figure that I wanted to take a look at. Does anybody have any questions? Going a bit quickly, yes.
So I just want to make sure I understood some of it. This interesting trend of the women taking charge of education and schooling and a lot of literature, that trend was really Sephardic and not mirrored in the Ashkenazi.
Doesn't seem, not to this extent, certainly. I mean, there's like a whole litany of these women, and I think what often goes unnoticed is that it seems to be something that's kind of happening in the Sephardic world. It's not that you don't find any Ashkenazim doing this, but all of a sudden you start having like a whole list of them within the Sephardic community. It feels like, wow, within the Sephardic community, that's kind of their, you know, their role. And are they doing it because the men aren't doing it and so they have no choice but to do it? Is it because it's a value in the community that the women should be doing it? It's interesting, you know, but it seems that it's during this time, in the middle of the 19th century, that that's when this is happening, you know. And that part of it, again, is responding to those issues that we wrote on the board at the beginning, right, where they kind of have to take charge. They can't take things for granted. They have to really kind of, you know, times are changing and they need to kind of change the way that they're going about doing things as well. Right, and they need material in English. The children now are all born in America, right? It's a different reality from the previous generation. Okay, one other person that I wanted to look at was Louisa Hart. Louisa Hart, also from one of these kind of old colonial families, and Louisa Hart is interesting. What we know from her a bit is, and one, this is one of the things we find with a bunch of them, is they do a lot of correspondence. You know, they're kind of writing to other writers, to other, sometimes non-Jewish people, other Jewish people, different places. And the person to kind of succeed these women, her name is Mary Cohen. And so she actually takes the writings of this Louisa Hart after her death and will publish her letters and her diary, parts of her diary. The reason she does that is that she has a bit of an agenda with doing that because of the material that she finds in them that I guess she thinks is important for people to see. And so I'm just going to quote here a little bit. This is from a scholar named Diane Ashton. So she writes the following. She says, you know, why did you go ahead and kind of publish this material from her mentor? Why is she writing? So she said the following. She argues that Cohen's goal in making her selection was, and to quote, to promote orthodoxy among American Jewish women. So one, again, that issue you're talking about, right, to kind of hold the line against reform, right? So apparently in her writings, she's kind of addressing those issues and maybe passionately. And so she wants to publish that other people should see that. And also to defend the respectability of single Jewish women, both as Jews and as women. And that's really interesting, right? That she actually thinks that there's like a real agenda, right? That A, that Jewish women should be, who are single, right, should be respected both as women in general, right? Just because you're not married doesn't mean you're not a woman, right? But that they should also be respected as Jews, right? That they actually have something really important to contribute to the Jewish community. And that, you know, again, is a really important thing because, again, you're finding that you have, you know, so many of these women who are not married, who are making these really important contributions, and that it's almost in a sense that maybe they even have like an agenda with it. You know, is it that some of them are doing it by choice because they feel that if they're married, they have responsibilities to their husband and to their children, and they don't want those responsibilities. They want to be able to do this kind of work, and so are, you know, making the choice to not get married. Maybe some just don't, you know, want to be married, right, for maybe gender reasons, or maybe some of them want to be married and don't find it, you know, which happens as well. So, you know, there could be different things, but it seems that there is this, though, goal to say that whatever the motivation is,
that they have an important role to play and that they should be respected in the community, right? And that their only role isn't to only be wives and mothers, but actually they have this important role in the community to, you know, found organizations and to lead organizations and to advocate and to write and to teach, and that they should be considered kind of respected figures in the community. And it seems that they were. They were, you know, these respected figures in the community. I think particularly in Philadelphia, where they were almost like a whole group of them, and they were like a team almost, that it was a sense of like, you know, oh, there's the, you know, there's the Sunday school ladies, or, you know, there's the ladies who are founding all of these important, you know, social welfare Jewish institutions, right? That there was a gravitas, you know, to them, that they had the respect of their, of their fellow, you know, Jews at Mikveh Israel. And that's, you know, I think that's an amazing, I mean, that's a really impressive kind of accomplishment that they made, you know, that in a sense, you know, I don't know that was something that they were given. It was something that they earned, you know, that they fought, that they showed, you know, that they demonstrated that they had this incredible value, even though they were perhaps living a life that was, unfamiliar, you know, to those around them, and showed that, you know, that was also a reasonable life choice as well, and a valued life, and that they should be valued members of the community as well. And that, so I think that's like a really, you know, amazing kind of thing that you find, I think, particularly within this, she's so much drawn to fury. She's engaging in polemic, you know, in her writings that perhaps are published after her death, but were certainly based on her writings as well. And so I think, you know, when you look at it and you kind of take this step back and you look at it and say, you know, this isn't just happening in London. This is not just like a London phenomenon, right? This is something that's happening, you know, across the shores, right? It's happening in America, right? It's an Anglo-American phenomenon, and then again, it's happening within the Sephardic community. Again, not that necessarily everybody here is ancestrally Sephardic, but they're all part of the Sephardic community, which I think is significant. The Sephardic communities are certainly somewhat more the elitist community, right? They're more well-to-do, they're more established, so there's certainly a class, you know, aspect to this as well. And the fact that you see it happening, you know, throughout this kind of Western Sephardic world, I think lays, you know, really the argument to say that, you know, this is something particular to the Sephardic community, and that it's something that they're particularly aware and concerned about those issues, to the extent that it's prompting, you know, these women to kind of take charge and to react to those issues. And that's despite the fact that there are, in some of these places, not all of them, there are Ashkenazi congregations as well, right? And so I think it's significant to see kind of the intense activity that's happening within the Spanish and Portuguese community. Is it happening perhaps because they are maybe feeling those challenges more strongly, perhaps as a result that they are higher class and therefore are more, sometimes poor people are more open to conversion because it's like their gain in. But sometimes people who are well off would have done conversion because that would get them just to the final stage of being involved in the community. But certainly they're dealing with issues of acculturation, issues of reform, and so on that are happening within the Sephardic community in the Spanish Portuguese community. And so that's really something that I've been thinking about and actually what I want to look at for our next series, which we're going to do after Passover, is to actually look at the role of division within the Jewish community during this time. So the next series we're going to do is going to be titled Breakaways, and we're going to be looking at the first breakaway synagogues in the Spanish and Portuguese world. We're going to be looking at Hamburg, where you have the first breakaway. Happens in 1818, so exactly 200 years ago, this October or November. We're going to look at London, of course, the West London Synagogue. We're going to look at the first breakaway in New York, which is called B'nai Jeshurun, and we'll look at the first breakaway in Charleston, which is called Sherith Israel. And in each situation, there's different issues going on: reform, tradition, custom, Ashkenazim, distance, there's different factors going on, but you see kind of with all these communities, there is conflict that's happening, right? And that's partly what's happening in these places, and I think what's happening with all these women of kind of why they're getting involved. And all those things happen between the year of like 1818 and 1843. So you're dealing with a very short amount of time that you're having all of these kind of divisions that are starting to take place. And I think it's being felt acutely within the Sephardic world, within the Spanish Portuguese community, and that's prompting a lot of these responses. We're going to kind of spend a class on each of those cases to see what actually happened, what's going on with them. Yeah, Stuart, did you have a...
Yeah, can I take it back a little bit?
Yeah, please.
The Northern European tradition, the English tradition, and the Empire tradition was that women taught and did, if they married, they had to leave. Florence Nightingale, when she came back from Crimea and tried to professionalise nursing, made that an absolute. You couldn't be a nurse and be married.
Right, that was it.
So
yeah.
That was it. But it didn't happen in France, it didn't happen in Italy, it didn't happen in Spain.
That even once you're married, you could continue doing
those roles? No, because the education wasn't with women, it was by priests.
Oh, even in the first place, it wasn't an issue.
So it was a different tradition.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be reinforced by Florence Nightingale. And the other thing was that, of course, by about 1850, 1860s, you could write a letter from London, send it to Philadelphia, and get a reply within a month, not in 3 or 6 months, as
right.
It was before.
Yeah.
So, that was the equivalent to the internet. Things moved rapidly in terms of ideas, in terms of books being sent across and being read.
So it's interesting, a lot of this is happening just before that then.
Yeah.
You know, when it's still a bit slower.
But it's
starting that sense of connection.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to see the parallels. I mean, obviously, you know, we know the connection between America and Britain before the revolution, but you see the kind of the way that those, there are a lot of those parallels remain, you know, well after it's taken, you know, that's happened.
I was also wondering if the fact that because the Sephardic community is both here and across the pond, were more settled, there was the opportunity to do other things rather than establish yourself. The first generation of immigrant wants to establish themselves, men or women, it's irrelevant. They need to adjust, get a job, make a living.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think
there's less time to think about life and the meaning of it.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, like I mentioned, a bunch of the people we're looking at are well off, right? But some of them we know right in order to make money because they're not well off. So it's a bit the ones who are doing the poetry, Heinemann and Grace Aguilar, it seems they're doing it because they got to make some money because they're not from the upper class. The other ones, the upper class, right? They're doing it just because they want to do good things. That's what upper class women are supposed to do, I guess. And some of them are not even putting their names onto some of their materials because it's not about their reputation. It's about, you know, doing this good work. So yeah, I think that's a really good point.
Do we know why they went to Philadelphia?
So there were Spanish Portuguese communities in all the major cities from British colonial times because those were trade. They went for trade and to work, you know. There was in New York, Philadelphia, Charleston, Savannah, Newport, Rhode Island, all the kind of the major cities of colonial America, and then they just remained, right? They were there, but they kept those connections, they kept those links with the community across, and you know, for me, this has been a really eye-opening series because I wasn't aware of this. You know, I wasn't aware of most of these people. A lot of these people, you know, maybe people knew them in the 19th century, but then when their material stopped being, you know, read, times change, people, you know, produce new materials, you know, most of them, for the most part, were forgotten. You know, obviously a couple of them, Grace Aguilar was known, Judith Monteferri was known, and Rebecca Gretz was known. The rest of them, not really. You know, and so all of a sudden diving into this to realize that, wow, you know, there were a lot of these women doing this. You know, it was this phenomenon, it was this movement as it were, that was taking place. And that was really exciting to see that, because one of the things that people often talk about when they talk about Anglo-Jewry and Anglo-American Jewry from this time is the dearth of intellectual Jewish activity. It's a thing people still talk about within the Anglo-Jewish community, right? That it hasn't produced, you know, the scholarship of other Jewish communities. And what's interesting is that, while that might be true, it's interesting that the women try to pick up the slack.
They have been Jewish people. You know, it's not recognized, but you know, it's different. It's not the same.
Yeah, well, exactly. They're not doing classical rabbinic writings and things like that.
Yeah.
So it's just really interesting how the women step forward to fill that gap. And that doesn't happen in other places, right? That doesn't happen in German Jewry and things like that, where you have, you know, reform and you think, oh, women would be doing those types. No, it's not. It's happening within these Orthodox, traditional Sephardic communities in, you know, England and America, that women are, in a sense, taking the lead, you know, in this. And we kind of look at the history of, you know, gender roles and feminism and so on. The Sephardic community is kind of ahead of the game of saying, well, yeah, let's be traditional, let's be, you know, but the women can also, you know, engage in these writings, which I think is amazing. I think it's really important.
In the German community, it came later. Because Else Lapke Schule and what's the other one, were all publishing books at the beginning of the 90s, about 50 years later than those. But partly also because of at the same time, the German Jewish community was not at the same level, let's call it integration.
But I'm saying, but it's the men are doing it.
Yeah,
but that's what I'm saying. There are men doing it. Here, there aren't men doing it. But they don't have women do it. We have women do it. It's, you know, it's kind of a bit of a flip.
But you could look on it as the continuation process that you said. That as conversos, it was the women that
kept
the education.
Yeah, that might be their explanation.
And that sort of tradition carries on.
Yeah.
And survives the sort of
reintegration,
because it's so great.
Yes, it's impossible.
And they probably
yes.
knew more than the men.
In certain ways, yeah, because they're doing it at home, right? It was the only religion they were doing was at home.
Yeah,
because you couldn't do it anyplace else.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's possible.
Because there's also the thing that in a conversos world, the education would come at a specific time, from as we're saying, from woman to woman. It was usually before the marriage, that the mother or the grandmother or the bride-to-be would take the woman aside and say, look, this
yeah.
is what...
So it needs a little more research. You need a little more research to really... I think it needs a little bit more research to really connect the dots and say, this is because of Converso, but it might be something that's going on there that's worth looking at. In any case, there's clearly something going on, which is something that kind of came out to me from this series.
Because, I mean,
let me just take this question in the back.
I was wondering about the sort of predominance of Ashkenazi versus Sephardic communities, because you also mentioned breakaway, so we're for your later history.
Yeah.
So were some of them combined? Coming from the U.S., I always have perceived that the Sephardic community is much so much smaller than the Ashkenazi community. And the beauty of seeing the depth of these communities, it makes me wonder back then, were the Sephardic communities larger?
They were all the Jewish community, essentially.
At that time.
America was Sephardic. You know, and it's really by the time you get to the middle of the 1800s where you start having German Jewish immigration. Now, it's not that there aren't Ashkenazim there, but the Ashkenazim that are there join the Sephardic synagogues.
So the predominant communities are all the Sephardic.
Exactly.
Even though my Sephardic folks came over there.
Okay. Right, that's a different Sephardic group, right? But this Sephardic group, exactly.
And in London, similar, all Sephardic?
No. In London, there's Ashkenazi community from
and
earlier on.
What's the predominance?
Ashkenazim are larger, but the Sephardim are wealthier. Again, because they're merchants, they're traders, and Ashkenazim tend to be more... There are some wealthy Ashkenazim as well, merchants, but also a lot of them are peddlers and things like that. Yeah.
So the Sephardim might be more business owners?
No, owners, they're merchants.
Merchants.
Trading, you know, international trade, those kinds of things. So some of them are quite well off. Though there is poverty in the Sephardic community as well. But as overall, the community is a bit more established, wealthier, though the Ashkenazi community is a larger number.
And the Sephardim didn't welcome the Ashkenazi.
fine. Why don't we wrap it up here? I want to thank everyone for coming to the series. I really enjoyed it. I learned a ton and really enjoyed teaching everyone. And I'm really excited about the next series. So looking forward to
will that be more controversial?
Bringing you the breakaways. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Sorry,
get ready. When we do the West London one, we're gonna have this. You get the real story of what really happened. Exactly. Thank you, everyone.